I'm going to say this is KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida. And this evening I've got my co-host, Dr. Eric Carlstrom, a professor of geography at California State University, Stanislaus, with nearly 30 years of teaching experience. His academic research has focused on using ancient soils, paleosols, and landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And our special guest this evening is Dr. Nick Begich. And he's the eldest son of the late U.S. Congressman from Alaska, Nick Begich, Sr., and political activist Peggy Begich. He is well known in Alaska for his own political activities and was twice elected president of both the Alaska Federation of Teachers and the Anchorage Council of Education. He has been pursuing independent research in the sciences and politics for most of his adult life. Nick Begich has received a Doctor of Medicine, Medicina Alternativa, honoris causa, boy, those are words I've not tried to pronounce before, for independent work in health and political science from the Open International University for Complementary Medicines, Colombo, Sri Lanka, in November 1994. And he co-authored with Gene Manning the book Angels Don't Play This Harp, Advances in Tesla Technology. Begich has also authored Earth Rising, The Revolution Toward a Thousand Years of Peace, and his latest book on Earth Rising 2, The Betrayal of Science, Society and the Soul, both with the late James Roderick. His latest work is Controlling the Human Society and Soul, Human Mind, the Technologies of Political Control or Tools for Peak Performance, and has published articles in Science, Politics, and Education, and as well is a well-known lecturer, having presented throughout the United States and in 19 countries. And he's been a featured guest on thousands of radio broadcasts, reporting on his research activities, including new technologies, health, and earth science-related issues, and has also appeared on dozens of television documentaries and other programs throughout the world, including the BBC TV, CBC TV, Telemundo, and others. And he's served as an expert witness and speaker before the European Parliament and has spoken on various issues for groups representing citizens concerned, statesmen and elected officials, scientists, and others. Is a publisher and co-author of Earth Pulse Press and has served as tribal administrator, village planner for the Chickaloon Village Council, a federally recognized American Indian tribe of the Athabascan Indian Nation for 5 years, and served 4 years as the executive director of the Lay Institute of Technology, Incorporated, a Texas nonprofit corporation, and currently consults for tribal organizations, private corporations, and others in a number of research areas. So, welcome, Dr. Begich.
Well, thanks for having me. Sorry about the long bio. You could have shortened that up a bit.
I know, I was trying to find a shorter one, but wasn't successful. Dr. Carlson.
Well, if I could just add to that bio, just one more thing. Dr. Begich also maintains a website called earthpulse.com. I was on it the other day, and he features a number of very interesting DVDs. Which I have not yet seen, but I intend to order and take a look at on the issues of HARP and mind control and things like that. So maybe we could start, Nick, with that topic, HARP, and as it pertains to geoengineering. You have been you've written the book Angels Don't Play This HARP with Gene Manning. So this is something I think most Americans don't know anything about. So maybe we could just get you to tell us what it is and what it does.
Sure. HARP is the High-Frequency Active Auroral Research Project based here in Alaska, and it's currently run by, operated by DARPA, which is does mainly defense research, and it's just for the various branches of the military. It has a number of uses, primarily communications and surveillance-based technology, but it has some unusual capacities in terms of what it can do. It is the largest radio frequency transmitter of this design ever built, and it actually focuses radio frequency energy into a relatively small area, and then utilizing that energy manipulates various features of our environment, particularly the ionosphere, which is associated with the character and quality of terrestrial communications, wireless communications, obviously. And the nature of the ionosphere is such that when it becomes disturbed by solar events, as an example, you get disturbances in communications across the planet. You can even get at real high energy levels interference with the power grid. What HARP was intended to do initially was learn a little bit more about the character of the ionosphere and then see if we could manipulate it to our advantage during periods of disruption, be able to stabilize it, or conversely, in situations where you'd want to disturb communications, be able to perturb it in such a way as to be able to accomplish that. Those were kind of the early discussions about what HARP could do. Ben Eastland, the inventor, Dr. Eastland, had a number of other ideas that he continued to develop up until his death in 2007. And some of those started to get into the idea of weather modification on a much more aggressive level than what he thought was originally possible with systems like HARP.
Yeah, and we're actually talking about technologies that can be used not only for weather modification but also for weather warfare, including creating artificially creating droughts, artificially creating drugs, floods, steering hurricanes, and even inducing artificial earthquakes. I think the thing that is difficult for most people to get their minds around is that we're dealing with electromagnetic radiation. We're dealing with things that we can't see. Radio waves, for instance, we all, you know, tune in our radios, but we really, most of us don't understand what radio waves are, and that they are just part of the electromagnetic spectrum, which goes from very, very tiny wavelengths of energy, including X-rays and gamma rays, et cetera, up to very, very long wavelengths of energy. Again, we can't see it, but these things all can be manipulated for various purposes, positive and negative. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, part of that is just recognizing that there are certain you could almost draw an analogy, like we're on radio today. People dial through the radio. They get a harmony, a resonance between the transmitter and the receiver, and they get a nice clear signal when they hit the station. In between, it's basically static. And you can look at that and sort of overlay that radio frequency energy in that broader spectrum beyond what is on broadcast radio. And then you start to look at what other kinds of resonance effects can you create, harmonies can you create. And this is where you start to look at physiological effects in terms of living organisms, and you also look at sort of the mechanical effects of the planet. And, you know, often, for instance, with earthquakes, low-frequency wavelengths are often associated with precursors to earthquake activity, as an example. Other activity, even weather activity associated with certain energetic fields. In fact, Eastland took it a little bit further, and he believed that by manipulating gravitational fields in a very specific way, in gravity waves, he was thinking of being able to manipulate these in a very dramatic way using HARP. And his last paper that he did for the University of Pennsylvania on this subject, he determined that you could literally manipulate these wavelengths in such a way as to affect weather systems with 1,600 times less power than when he originally invented HARP. In other words, he figured out a different mechanism using a different wavelength to affect sort of the underlying mechanisms of what he believed drives or would drive major weather shifts or weather patterns. But it's that kind of science, that idea of sort of tuning in to the planet in just such a way with just the right amount of energy to trigger energy that otherwise is naturally stored and released within the planet, whether it be in the ionosphere or whether it be in fault zones within the planet itself. In fact, there was an idea that was kicked around And it was during the Clinton administration, and it came out of a DOD news briefing back in April of 97, and it was William Cohen, who was Secretary of Defense at the time, and he made the following quote, and it says, "Others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter climate, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves," unquote. Now, if you stop and think about that, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, climate change, all triggered by what Cohen said, electromagnetic waves. Now, that's just not random, like the static between the stations. This is very precise energy designed to do a very specific thing, to couple with the Earth and then to trigger events within the Earth. And that's essentially what this science is about, and HARP happens to be the largest energy transmitter ever designed of its type to create not just these effects, but many other effects as well.
Well, if I could jump in, Nick, with another quote that's perhaps fairly well known, at least amongst the people that are looking into this. Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who wrote a book in the 1970s, I believe 1972, wrote a book called Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era.
Right.
And by the way, Brzezinski is one of the main men behind our present president, Barack Obama, in terms of advising capacity. He stated back in 72, "Technologies will make available to the leaders of the major nations techniques for conducting secret warfare of which only a bare minimum of the security forces need be appraised. Technology of weather modification could be used to produce prolonged periods of drought or storm, uses of weather and other weapons for mind control." So obviously, even back in 72, it was understood that this is where this was going to be a big thing in the coming decades.
Right. In fact, that quote I used in a couple of different publications, the HARP book, we used that quote. And actually, there's a predecessor quote that goes back to 1969 to J.F. Gordon MacDonald. And Brzezinski quotes him. And MacDonald was a science advisor to Lyndon Johnson. And he was also a full professor of geophysics at UCLA. And one of the things that he had suggested and Brzezinski picked up on was if we could ever figure out how to electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way, that we could create a signal that would affect the behavior of people over a huge geographic area. And that showed up in a book called Unless Peace Comes, published in 1969. And, you know, that whole idea, that concept that then Brzezinski played on in 72 was advanced even further if you look from 72 to the present. The kinds of technologies, the kinds of systems that would be necessary would be these large broadcast systems that could concentrate energy and then utilize the natural energy systems of the planet to sort of carry that signal. And in fact, that's what happens with HARP, not just for affecting human behavior and biological systems, but just using the magnetic field lines that surround the Earth as even waveguides for other weapons applications are part of the HARP scenario. So a very different step. I mean, where we used to think of weapons as bombs and bullets, things that blew up and tore tissue, now we're looking at systems that are designed specifically to interact with very large natural systems, the energetic systems of the planet itself. And that's where we get very concerned, and others have expressed concern, you know, over the years as we've continued to advance public awareness on this particular project.
And of course, you mentioned. Sorry, go ahead, Melody.
When you're talking about that affecting the behavior of humans with the with this particular weapon, would it if there was high concentrations of metals that were in being dispersed within the atmosphere, would that have a contributing factor to this?
Not necessarily. In fact, there's a lot of discussion about that I've seen on the Internet. It's totally unnecessary to create an effect, number one. The idea of dispositing aluminum or barium, which is often what's associated with those discussions, into the atmosphere has been cited, but the sampling is really poor. I mean, firstly, aluminum in the environment is pretty common. In fact, in the places where this has been reported, there's a couple of things that should be noted. There was a doctoral dissertation done a number of years ago. It later became a book called The Secret Lives of Dust. It was written by Hannah Holmes. And what she determined was there are two major dust flows, one coming from the North Africa and the Sahara region. And the way they discovered this was there was a bauxite, an aluminum deposit, discovered on one of the islands in the Bahamas, that under it was coral, which is an organic material, and above it then bauxite and then corals above that. And they're trying to figure out, how do you get a bauxite deposit, an aluminum deposit in the middle of this? And then if you look at the soils of the southeastern United States, they're an orange soil with a very high aluminum content. That soil, people believe, and scientists now believe, is probably largely deposited from dust from the Sahara. Likewise, on the west coast from California all the way up to the southern portions of Alaska, you have dust coming in from Southeast Asia now carrying every kind of heavy metal and toxin you can imagine coming out of Asia into the west coast of the United States. So people who are sampling are finding samples and finding the occurrence of aluminum and other processed metals, but these are now so widely dispersed in our environment. Unless you're sampling at the point of discharge, where these particulate materials are being discharged from an aircraft or something like this, you really can't make a clear conclusion from our perspective. And the other one is barium.
If I could just interject here, I think what Melody's referring to is the whole discussion about chemtrails and what Rosalind Peterson calls persistent contrails. And there's absolutely no question that method spraying campaigns have been going on for 20 years without the public's knowledge or consent. In fact, in Crestone, Colorado, on Monday morning, which was a clear morning, I counted about 32 different trails, in the sky. And so there is, I think, a real legitimate connection there between weather modification, because one of the things that happens is you create artificial high-level clouds, cirrus clouds, which dims the amount of incoming solar radiation, actually reduces it, so it becomes a problem for plants and animals and people.
Sure.
And then so it's a gigantic issue in and of itself. And then the question I think Melody was alluding to is it being used in a concert combination with HAARP? And there are many people who say that yes, if you zap the suspended aluminum and metals with wavelengths of electromagnetic energy, you can effectively warm that part of the sky and keep the water vapor from condensing. And by warming the atmosphere, you could therefore induce drought. And it seems to me that this can be proven experimentally anywhere. In a little test tube almost, a little chamber. So it does seem like they can be working together. But I have to also say that as a soil scientist, aluminum is very common constituent of the earth. It's, I think it's like third or fourth most common element in the earth. And aluminum oxides and hydroxides and iron oxides and hydroxides build up due to chemical weathering in soils over time, especially in warm climates such as you have in the southeast. So if you've got a high aluminum content in the soil in, say, Georgia or Brazil or something like that, it's due to the fact that that soil has been weathering over hundreds of thousands, sometimes even millions of years, and the chemical weathering processes leave aluminum and iron as residual components of the soil. So no doubt there's dust that gets around the world, but soils are aluminum and iron factories as well as clay. They produce that stuff over time by chemical weathering.
Now, one thing I'll say, too, about the this whole chemtrails issue is relative to creation of cirrus clouds. This is something that was first noted back in the 1980s, and there was research on that could not be confirmed, take it from theory to fact, until actually 9/11, when they shut down air traffic throughout the United States, and atmospheric scientists were then able to prove their models that actually it was, it's basically aircraft that is contributing significantly more than they ever imagined, sort of downwind in the formation of cirrus clouds. Now, when you look at air traffic and international freight traffic, and if you were to graph that on a scale, you would see this very sharp rise coming out of the 1970s forward, where we were increasing air traffic at unprecedented levels to the point where to try and compare atmospheric conditions then to now, you really have to consider the fact that we are contributing to weather, not just by what people are considering greenhouse gases, but just by the formation of clouds with the incredible amount of air traffic. The other thing we've done is change the formulations of some of our jet fuels that don't allow for as clean of a burn as we may have once gotten. And that has some contributing factors. There are also new, there's actually new jet fuels being formulated that are partially biofuels that are a bit different in chemistry. And then you have atmospheric conditions changing generally. I mean, here in Alaska, I live next to an Air Force base. I grew up next to it. And seeing jet trails in our atmosphere, particularly in subarctic type of conditions, is pretty common. But as temperature situations change across the planet, I think people are observing more for a variety of reasons. One is there's more traffic, and secondly, the recognition that that these contrails do contribute to cloud formation. I think that's very valid. The idea of spraying something to damage the public, there have been instances that have been proven in the literature that have been acknowledged by our government of participating in those kinds of activities. So none of that particularly surprises me. If you have metals present, can you take advantage of those with systems like HARP? And the answer is yes. In fact, if you have any chemical constituent that you can resonate a signal off of, you can create a very toxic environment that is unexplainable. I'll give you a good example. Robert Becker used this actually in one of his publications years ago, and what he said was essentially that, you know, all of us, if we're healthy, have a certain amount of iodine within our body. And iodine, when it gets excessive, can make us very sick, can even kill us. But if you do the normal test, check the thyroid, look at iodine levels, you'll get some conclusions. And then if you were to resonate a signal, send a signal in that was at the same resonant frequency of iodine, the body, the human body, would begin to react. If it had just gotten a massive dosage of iodine, it'll exhibit all of the various symptoms of iodine poisoning, yet when they check iodine levels, everything appears normal. This can easily be done with any electromagnetic system if you can figure out how to carry a signal on it of the right frequency and the right range to trigger these kinds of events. Well, every chemical constituent, every element has a unique frequency associated with it, so that if you can create a signal that harmonizes with that signal, you can create effects. So if you were in a battlefield, as an example, and you were to dump a specific chemical into that battlefield that affected all of your adversaries and you kept your troops away from it, you could then send a signal in, and only those exposed to that chemical or that metal or that constituent would be affected by the broadcast signal. So, you know, when you think about very precise and precision kind of an attack on a population, you could see how this could be delivered, and yet you'd have no viable explanation of what the heck happened. And the same with weather modification. It's why during Cheney's time and Rumsfeld's time recently at the White House, they wanted to abandon weather modification treaties we had signed in the 70s. And their rationale was the technology is too good. You know, we can raise a totally clandestine war, and nobody would even know they were in a war. You know, they just wouldn't have the ability to grow food, either from flood or from drought. That's the kind of warfare scenarios that are being anticipated and probably being played out today. Problem is there's no ability to model the entire Earth system and understand the consequences of each of these actions.
Dr. Begich, now that same premise would be what homeopathy is based on, correct?
It's a very similar idea. You know, in fact, the idea of using very small amounts of material and getting it into the body where the body can then react with it, I suppose that's sort of the light version. You know, man's version is, now we know what we can do with a feather. Let's get a sledgehammer and see what happens. and I think that's where we've kind of gone awry, because we're looking at very big systems today that are changing the face of warfare. In fact, they call it now and have for the last couple of decades, a revolution in military affairs, that they equate to the same kind of changes that took place when atomic weapons were introduced in the last century or gunpowder in the centuries before. The change of using energy as a basis of weapon systems in a much different way, not in the sense of burning and tearing tissue, but degrading performance of humans, which is really the objective of war, is to degrade the performance of your adversary so they cannot wage war. In a modern context, the idea of rebuilding nations has become pretty burdensome. We can look at Iraq and Iran and sort of what's happening in that part of the world in terms of shutting down economies and then what it takes to restart them. You know, on one side, we've tried to shut Iran down unsuccessfully. Iraq, we have totally obliterated, and yet really haven't solved anything. And so the idea of a lot of these systems is, well, how can we engage in control of our adversaries without necessarily having all of the political consequences that are associated with it? And this is one of them, the ability to raise warfare models in a manner that doesn't alert the public, doesn't alert your adversary, and results in the outcomes you're looking for. And ultimately, it's the outcomes that drive the policy decisions.
Well, do you find that?
Just to give a background here, you know, when you talk about Bernard Eastland, the guy who came up with some patents that are being used at HAARP, he acknowledged that a lot of his ideas came from the Serbian genius Nikola Tesla, who worked in the last part of the 19th century, and is the guy who invented alternating current and the radio, and understood electromagnetic radiation better than anybody did at that time. And he has said that he invented a thing called the death ray. He also invented wireless, where he thought he could provide energy for the whole world, you know, transmitted across the atmosphere rather than through wires. And he also stated that if he interfered the right frequencies, that he would have the power to split the Earth in two.
Now, right.
We're dealing with some very, very powerful technologies here that were not used in this country, because in 1942 he died, I think, the night before he was supposedly going to meet with our President Roosevelt, and who knows if it was a peaceful death, natural or not. But anyway, most of his materials, including many of his, a lot of his research and patents, were sequestered and taken off by the military at that time. Then we don't see the military talking about this, but we do see the Soviet Union developing this, unbeknownst to most Americans. And there's a very fascinating interview by Tom Bearden, Colonel Tom Bearden, in 1984, called Soviet Weather Control Over the United States. And
right.
He talks about their Woodpecker signal and how they were actually able to steer the jet stream, create drought, create floods.
Right.
So this thing has a long history that most people don't know about.
That's
and
exactly.
I would argue also that the Star Wars research that was heavily subsidized by the U.S. government had a lot to do with bringing this technology into our own military capabilities. So I'm just trying to set the stage that this is not something that is new. This is something that's been around, and it has enormous power, more power than atom nuclear bombs.
Right. In fact, we had over 300 source documents in the book, Angels Don't Play This HAARP, on this subject, and we trace that history going back many, many decades up to the present time. And I knew Bernard Eastland very well, and we'd become good friends over the course of the controversy. And Ben's attitude was much different than many that I had run into, because we were considerate of the fact that as a research scientist, everybody is sort of narrowed into their own sort of bandwidth. And so there's not a whole lot of generalists, and there's not a lot of overlap within the disciplines. And Eastland, instead of feeling and, you know, getting incensed by the fact that we were challenging his work in terms of what the outcomes would be, instead, he looked at what we were doing. He reached out to us as we had to him And we maintained a dialogue with Dr. Eastland from 1994 all the way to his death in 2007. And I had the opportunity to invite him as my guest when I was working with the Lay Institute to a closed conference on the mind effects issue in just a few months before he had passed away. And we'd brought together a group of specialists, you know, on this subject. And one of the big revelations that came out of that discussion with Dr. Eastland, he had made a presentation, you know, on HARP, on sort of the good side and the bad side of the technology. And the big conclusion is, you know, you can't know everything and you need to remain open. And what Dr. Eastland started doing in his published work is encouraging his colleagues to not get so defensive when they're challenged by others, but to actually listen to those challenges and consider them in light of the fact that not everybody knows everything, and you need to take into consideration full effects. And so as he approached the science, he became somewhat concerned. He had a great relationship with DARPA, I can tell you, all the way to the very top. But in some areas, he felt that the military was not the best place to experiment. And weather modification, particularly on the systems he was developing, because his view of that was, if we allow this to be done in a clandestine way, the risks are just too great. It needs to be done, if done ever at all, in the open light of day with a multidisciplinary approach to it to avoid the kinds of risks that otherwise are associated with this kind of work. And the military is not the place to advance this kind of research, only in the fact that the ionosphere or any other constituent of our environment that we all rely on, no military, ours or anyone else's, should be allowed to experiment there and place all of us at a level of risk.
Yeah, and we should mention that, of course, the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Navy, and Raytheon corporations are really, and the Pentagon in general, are amongst the principal sponsors of the HARP facility in Gulkona, Alaska. And that even though HARP is the most powerful of these ionospheric heaters, there are some, 20 others around the world?
Right, you have them.
That can do similar kinds of things.
Yeah, they have them in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, across northern Canada, across Europe. The Chinese have one in Antarctica. The Russians have 5 old transmitters and maybe some new ones. This is not unique to the United States. Many are experimenting in this area, and it's becoming increasingly so. Now, we started reporting on this now 15 years ago, and I can tell you over 15 years, none of our positions have changed relative to this technology. And over time, we've been proven correct. You know, we've seen the European Parliament act on this technology as a result of our efforts there. The Russian Duma, because of presentations and material that they had on the same technology, and others now have raised this issue literally around the world, because we're at a stage where these technologies, and this is just one example of them, they're going to determine to a large extent what this world looks like in the coming this coming century. And this generation is going to be the deciders of how technology is deployed and what kinds of risks we as a population are willing to accept.
Dr. Begich, is there a possibility with this would be, if used incorrectly, could be much more concern than even maybe atomic weapons?
I think so on some levels. You know, I mean, these are very powerful systems. They change the game substantially. They don't leave radioactive residue that sort of eliminates your ability to use the place you just conquered. So in that sense, it's a much cleaner technology and offers, again, offers military planners an opportunity to do some things that previously was just not possible.
I've done some
technology.
But let me just do a go ahead, Melody.
I've done some work with Captain Eric May, and he had done a major written a number of articles on observing something down in Texas City that was the equivalent of something you describe in some of your work about being able to create these huge explosions in the atmosphere. And he was claiming that that is what he observed at some point and made, you know, caused great, you know, great concern to him. So,
yeah, there's, you know, this whole area, as I said, is exploding in terms of technology and advances. The problem is there's not the kind of independent oversight. And it's not just our country, and I want to emphasize that. There are a lot of governments involved in this kind of research, all of them looking, for the same kind of answers. The idea of changing the game so dramatically is pretty profound. The idea of being able to manipulate energy to affect people in this way is something that just was not possible even 20, 30 years ago. What is now possible with this science is pretty far-reaching. In fact, there's a great article, if you look at a publication at the U.S. Army War College called Perimeters, there was an article called The Mind Has No Firewalls. And it's actually a reprint of a Russian military journal, and the whole discussion is about how to manipulate the behavior of people. And using energy as the source, what they say is that any energy source can be manipulated, whether it be a radio broadcast, TV, telephone, the power grid itself, the internet, anything that carries an electromagnetic signal, you can put on it a signal that the body or the mind will couple to, will recognize and react to. That's pretty profound. I mean, and any system can be used for this. In fact, I'll read you a direct quote out of that article because it really lays it out pretty clearly. And it says, and I quote, "A psychotronic generator which produces a powerful electromagnetic emanation capable of being sent through telephone lines, TV, radio networks, supply pipes, and incandescent lamps. This signal would manipulate the behavior of those in contact with the signal," unquote. And again, a very small amount of energy. It's not the idea that you have to have this huge amount that burns tissue or tears tissue. Subtle amounts of energy drive our entire living organism, our body. Being able to interfere with that in a very subtle way by interfering literally with the circuitry of the body is what this is all about. And it has a two-edged sword. On the one hand, you can destroy a human being, but on the other hand, knowledge of this technology leads in another direction, and it leads towards the underlying mechanisms within our physical health. In other words, we can figure out ways to manipulate body chemistry by manipulating the energy within the body, and many have done this historically, shows up in literature here and there. What I can tell you is energy medicine as a concept coming out of sort of the weaponization of energy in this way is going to change health in terms of this country and the world. I think in the next 20 to 30 years, we're going to see a trend moving significantly away from the chemical models of health to electrochemical models, and from that on to what are more realistic models for human health, which is sort of the electromagnetic nature of the body that drives all of those chemical processes. And when we have a good understanding of that, then we will have a greater understanding of the damage we have done with the systems we've created. And that day is coming.
Does this tie into some of Royal
Rife? Yeah, if I could follow up on that, Melody.
Okay.
You asked about the explosion in Texas. One of the things that HARP can do is it can create a plume of electrically charged particles that can then be exploded when ignited by an electromagnetic pulse, which HARP can also. So HARP can create the plasma and then create the electromagnetic pulse that will cause the plasma or the electrically charged atoms or gases to explode. And
right.
This may be what he was talking about.
Could very well
would you,
be.
You
one of the other ideas within the patent, there was another idea where you could actually create a large weather balloon like object, fill it up with very fine magnesium particles, and then by hitting it with RF, radio frequency energy, you could cause all of it to discharge, to explode at once. And what it would create is a megaton yield without a radioactive fallout. And they were looking at that within the HARP patents. In fact,
wow.
You mentioned those. And they were looking at that to create EMPs, artificial EMPs, by using that kind of power, an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse that would interfere with, say, electronic devices, but doing it in a way where you wouldn't have the residual radioactive fallout that, you know, causes all the other problems. So that was, you know, that was one of the concepts that actually did show up within the literature. Doing it without a containment would be interesting, and maybe that's possible as well, and perhaps that's what the individual in Texas was referring to.
Now, I've got a quote here that you have in your own book, Angels Don't Play This Harp. It's from the New York Times, September 1940. And this is, of course, taking us back to Tesla. He's still alive at that point. Nikola Tesla, one of the truly great inventors who celebrated his 84th birthday on July 10th, tells the writer that he stands ready to divulge to the United States government the secret of his, quote, teleforce, with which, he said, airplane motors would be melted at a distance of 250 miles so that an invisible Chinese wall of defense could be built around the country. Now, that sounds, of course, a little bit like Star Wars. This, quote, teleforce, he said, is based upon an entirely new principle of physics that, quote, no one has ever dreamed about, unquote, different from the principle embodied in his inventions relating to the transmission of electrical power from a distance, from which he has received a number of basic patents. This new type of force, Mr. Tesla said, would operate through a beam 1/100,000,000th of a square centimeter in diameter and could be generated from a special plant that would cost no more than $2 million and would take only about 3 months to construct. The beam, he states, involves four new inventions, two of which already have been tested. One of these is a method and apparatus for producing rays and other manifestations of energy in free air, eliminating the necessity for a high vacuum. A second method is a method and process for producing, quote, very great electrical force. The third is a method for amplifying this force. And the fourth is a new method for producing, quote, a tremendous electrical repelling force, unquote. This would be the projector or gun of the system. The voltage for propelling the beam to its objective, according to the inventor, will attain a potential of 50 million volts. With this enormous voltage, he said, microscopic electrical particles of matter will be catapulted on their mission of defensive destruction. In other words, they'll fly apart. He has been working on this invention, he added, for many years and has recently made a number of improvements on it. Now, my question, Nick, is we've interviewed Dr. Judy Wood, who I think is probably the most qualified and most detailed researcher on what happened to the World Trade Center 9-1-1, and she believes that it was directed energy weapons that took the World Trade Center buildings 1, 2, and 7 down, that basically what happens is molecular dissociation. The buildings did not collapse. They more or less were vaporized in air, and all that steel and concrete turned to fine particles of dust, as if the actual particles were repelling each other. I find her website, drjudywood.com, to be very, very convincing. And in fact, I have a website, www.911nwo.com, which features her work and then moves it in other directions. But so my question to you, and I think one of the really interesting possibilities here, is that we may have a connection between what happened on 9-1-1 and HAARP. Would you see the connection there?
I could not say. I think about that, and I've seen a lot of things trying to reference HAARP, and I just don't see it, and not the way HAARP is configured. You know, maybe some other technology that might be associated with the systems or the underlying systems, but HAARP is designed to work on a less precision basis. To create a fine precision output like that would be quite difficult. It just doesn't have as narrow of a range. You know, when you reflect it off of the ionosphere down to the Earth, to control the spread of that signal is pretty difficult in that regard.
Yeah, it may be that that's you know, using similar forces in the sense of electromagnetic radiation, but what actually was used at 9-1-1 was different. For instance, Dr. Judy Wood has all these photos of these big smoky clouds coming up the sides of each of the World Trade Center buildings before they exploded, imploded, whatever happened, and she calls that lathering up. Well, if you start to read these things, you realize that by ionizing gases and creating a plasma, electrical plasma, out of those gases, and then zapping it with electromagnetic radiation, you can get that effect. Or if you, the vaunted death ray of Tesla was the idea that you would interfere two different wavelengths in a particular way, and Tom Bearden talks about this in his in his talk about Soviet weather engineering of the United States. You could create a scalar situation where the normal laws of physics don't apply.
Right, this may play into this, because the idea of utilizing multiple systems, multiple HAARP systems, creating a standing wave in the upper atmosphere, that kind of discussion has been had. The question is have they done it, and can we document it? And at this point, I've not been able to do it. Perhaps other researchers have. And I know Bearden had done a lot in this area, and we've reviewed his work, and, you know, it's pretty compelling. The questions always come in is, you know, where can you get the independent kind of verifications? And so much of our work has been centered on, you know, what's out there in the public literature to make our case. And so much of the work has been done in a clandestine way where we'll never see the full story in that respect. You know, so you have to either accept marginalized information, or you have to say, well, you know, let's see what else we can correlate. And with Bearden's work over time, I think things have started to correlate. A lot of the things that he and others have said that come out of that, you know, that sort of clandestine world. But time shows all, and I think time has shown that those that have been reporting on this issue over the past couple of decades have been correct, and Bearden is one of them.
Is he still alive, Nick?
I think he may still be. I get material. I think it's from one of his assistants, but I think he still is alive.
I've heard he's been sick, if he is.
Yeah, I think I've been getting from, I get like every few months something comes from someone who's been assisting him that sends material out to a list, and I'm on that list. So I see things coming from his research periodically.
Okay. Well, it seems like, see a direct correlation between what HAARP does and what happened to the World Trade Center buildings, which does seem to be a most unusual phenomenon. Judy Wood would say it was like a demonstration of a new technology as radically different as, say, nuclear technology was when the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, almost like a similar demonstration to the world of, look what we can do, back off, because we can do this anywhere.
I think that's...
It seems like with...
I was going to say that's probably a very realistic view of the world. I mean, that's how you do it. The fact is that every country will demonstrate a capacity at some point. The ideal is in a conflict situation. And it's more or less throwing down the gauntlet and saying, hey, you know, we have this now. And I think some of that has been going on. I mean, the kinds of advances in science that are taking place outside of the public view make what we've seen in the world today like driving the Model T. What is coming is going to be literally transformative. And against that transformation has to play in, and I guess that's been a lot of us who have been in this work in getting the public involved, is, does this really line up with the future world we want to see? You know, do these technologies support the kind of independent human living that we believe is necessary, you know, within the context of, you know, of how we want to live? And now you're talking about, and we're talking about, technologies that influence how we behave, not through propaganda and traditional sources of manipulation, but through direct interaction with us, with our mind and bodies, with interference, direct interference, not just propaganda, not just a challenge to our intellect, but the overriding of our capacity to engage the intellect. That is why, over the years, we've considered this to be the most important topic. And, it gets touched on in the HAARP story, but HAARP's become almost a metaphor for so many people. I mean, every time that there's a technologically related disaster, people want to point to HAARP. And while that's interesting, it's not the reason for all of these things, but it doesn't mean that all of these things that people are concerned about aren't necessarily being created by man. There are many weapon systems. HAARP is one of them within a class of weapon systems that are new. And I think that's the big message here is, the technologies have changed so dramatically. It's not just going to be about HAARP. It's going to be about a whole lot of systems that are getting a little bit of notoriety here and there. people come back to HARP because we've leaned on this issue so heavily over the years and tried to get the public aware of sort of the other things that interfere with the planet itself and human beings and living organisms. And HARP has provided a way to explain it because it's the biggest system that can mess things up, if you will. But as I've looked at this over the years, what I've also recognized is the flip side of this equation. These technologies are also a pointer in a direction that we're headed on the planet that will take us either to the point of destruction or the point of revolution, and not in a violent way, but in terms of a revolution in the way we think and the way we behave, based on new knowledge and based on technology, not based on manipulating people to fall into some line. That is the opposite end of what we hope will be the outcome. Good science applied to improving the human condition is a valid and worthy pursuit, but way too much of our science is spent on figuring out how to kill one another, unfortunately.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Judy Wood, who we did interview, and we have her interview archived on Melody's website, her archives, as well as my website, 911NWO.com. She said that, you know, by her technique was she's a materials engineer with a postdoc in optical interferometry. So she understands wavelengths of energy, and she understands mechanical engineering. She understands materials engineering. And she, by doing, you know, analyzing these thousands of photographs, she said, if I didn't know that directed energy weapons existed, I know they do now, because she looked at the materials and saw what happened to those materials. She also said, guess what, guys? Free energy exists. Now, free energy is one of those, you know, kind of, you know, holy grails that people have been talking about and looking at for years and years and years. And, of course, Tesla was ahead of everybody by, you know, at least a century on that. So this, if free energy exists, as the very, very sharp Dr. Judy Wood believes, then, you know, we don't need to be stuck with gas and oil and the pollution and wars and terrorism, whatever, that goes with that. There are alternatives that would make life easier, and I can understand why the ruling elite might not want everybody to get this. They might want to keep it a secret.
I think that's right.
What do you think about that?
I think that's absolutely right. I think that again, energy technologies are about to go through a huge shift, and if you've started monitoring some of the big oil companies, a lot of the biggest ones are selling off assets more than they traditionally would, and not just on the excuse of an oil spill in the Gulf. I think the trend is definitely a different direction, and what's happened is technology is relatively flat today. The ability to exchange ideas is flat today. Anyone can do it. The fact is there's a lot of governments, a lot of countries, a lot of portions and regions of the world that need energy technologies and really don't care about the multinationals and whether or not they maintain their markets, which ultimately so much of the debate is about. More than it is about a crisis, it's about an economic crisis for private corporations that are going to lose their market edge by controlling the energy monopolies of the planet. That's what Tesla was fighting against over 100 years ago before energy was even a big player. He saw it, he visioned it, and he believed that energy should be, in those days, as free as air and water, which today maybe isn't so free when you buy oxygen in Tokyo, I guess. But you know, the whole idea was that energy as a basic component for the industrial era was going to be a necessary ingredient. If you were to stick it on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it would be right down there with food, clothing, and shelter in the 21st century world. And so energy is the answer. A third of our economy is dedicated to energy consumption and production, and in terms of dollars to the economy. Half of our trade deficit is related to petrochemical products coming in the United States from gasoline, oil, jet fuel, raw crude, etc. And to move a different direction to where energy costs essentially become flatter and lower, what does that do? Well, all of a sudden now food production becomes more possible because controlled environmental growing within greenhouse environments is now economic. I mean, if you start to think about what does energy supply, it supplies our food, it supplies our, ultimately, to some degree, our fertilizers because of how they're based, and on and on and on. energy in the 21st century will either liberate us or free us, and the new energies is sort of the revisiting of old ideas is what's going to liberate us. And even in the healing arts, you know, when World War II started is when we went away from the electromechanical kind of models of the body and went heavily into the chemistry approaches, pharmaceutical approaches to health coming out of World War II. But prior to World War II, during the time of Reif and many others, there was a lot of work being done in this area that continues today in many parts of the world. And I think, again, that will be the revolution that sort of is rediscovered, not just in energy but in health sciences, again, based on the same basic underlying principles that are being now applied to military developments to the detriment of humankind, in my personal view.
Dr. Begich, I'm glad to hear you bring up Reif. Now, is his technology being accessible to many of us, or I was kind of getting information that maybe it wasn't quite as attuned as it should be. Are you following what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'll tell you, there's a lot of people out there selling things that they claim will do certain things, and they have absolutely no clear knowledge of even what they're talking about. And I don't say that lightly, because there is some very good science behind a lot of the things that are being pitched. It's just, it's almost premature in one sense, because it's not linking up the right kind of science with the technologies. You've got a lot of amateurs doing a lot of work, and I don't begrudge that, because the best science, I think, comes from that venue, you know, whether it be an airplane or a coffee maker or a home computer. But we do need to be a little bit cautious, only in this sense, is as we start to look at these things and sort of rediscover Reif, there are others who, independent of Reif, have developed methodologies for determining, like for pathogens, what specific wavelengths will destroy a specific pathogen. The work of Anu Makela in Finland, which is modern work done over the last 40 years, and by her father before her, she's actually broken down wavelengths for virtually every major pathogen and have isolated ways to destroy those. And she's actually been challenged by the medical authorities. Her and her father were challenged a number of years ago in Finland. They sustained through the courts and since that time have trained hundreds of medical practitioners in their method of healing as a legal form of healing in Finland, which is not an unsophisticated country. It's got some of the best science in the world coming out of Finland. It's where cell phones started, for goodness sakes. Whether it's good or bad, it's where it started. And when you think about this, is Reif, you know, he was standing in his time, and a lot of people have gone back and tried to duplicate his hardware and then produce it and create the effects. And that's all great, but you really need the physiological experience and background. And Anu Makela is one of the very few people I know on the planet that has it. And has developed a working model that is exciting and exceptional, and has treated over 20,000 patients between her father's practice and hers over a very long period of time in some of the most chronic disorders, and has had very good success. And essentially using energy as the medium and an understanding of how to manipulate that energy to create health effects.
And do you know if that's available other than just through them?
In Finland, you can get trained. You can go to her website. It's in Finnish and in English. It's emred.fi for Finland. And there's a lot of material there and information there that'll give people sort of an overview of what her research is about. And our website has a lot of material and references to this as well at earthpulse.com.
Okay, so that's how people get a hold of you, is at earthpulse.com.
Right.
Okay, and Dr. Carlson, if you want to give your websites, and I just want to also say this is KHENLPFM 106.9 Salida. Go ahead, Dr. Carlson.
Okay, well, I mentioned earlier my 911NWO.com website, which I've got a lot of material on, trying to understand what actually happened on 911. Of course, it was a conspiracy, but it wasn't by the Muslims. And then I've got another one called www.naturalclimatechange.us, I've just written an 80-page article called Disproofs of the Hypothesis of Unprecedented Catastrophic Man-Caused Climate Change, and proofs that AGW, or anthropogenic climate change, or anthropogenic global warming, is a fraud. So one of the interesting things to me about this whole thing, Nick, I'm a quaternarist. I've studied climates of the past couple million years, the Ice Age, and then as an earth scientist, it's, you know, take it back further. So anybody who's looked at the history of the earth knows that the amount of climate change we saw in the 20th century, which is reputed to be about 1 degree Fahrenheit warming for the planet, although that's that can be debated for a long time, that's very, very small compared to the range of natural climate variability that we've seen in the past.
Right.
Even my own work in Glacier Park shows the mean annual temperatures fluctuated in Glacier Park, Montana, by at least 16 to 18 degrees centigrade, which is about 30 times greater than what we saw in the 20th century. So it's actually rather easy to disprove this hypothesis. And yet,